Like, he has them do drills. He has them do warm-ups. He has them do, you know, movement exercises, expression ideas, even just, like, bear crawls, you know, just anything that kind of is not the furthest away from actually recording, rehearsing your ones and twos and threes and fours and fives.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Welcome to the second season of the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. I'm your host, Darren Tun, and with me is my co-host, Mike Messina. For today's episode, we are interviewing director Bao Tran and action director Ken Kitagawa from the Paper Tigers movie. For this episode, unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties. My internet wasn't working so well a couple minutes into the interview, so we just decided that Mike was going to take over the majority of this interview. Nonetheless, it was still a great interview. Really enjoyed listening to the conversation. Mike, what were some big takeaways for you?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just realizing that this movie is a kung fu film made by kung fu film fans, by people who really understand and respect the genre. And so this film in particular, Paper Tigers, is taking all of those tropes. You're preserving the awesome action and the focus on storytelling through that action. And then you're also taking those tropes and flipping them on its head and putting it in a modern context. And, you know, because it's such a fan servicing kind of piece, it was a crowdsourced, crowdfunded film. And so we also got to talk a little bit about the tough realities of that style of filmmaking, how it was tough, even tougher to raise the money in some ways than it was to actually make the film. And we also talk about how something like a tight shooting schedule is going to affect the different kinds of fight scenes that you can manage to complete in the way you originally want it. And then there's also the great stuff that goes exactly the way that they wanted it to. I was personally really interested in how both Ken and Bao, as action director and straight up director, both sort of approach their actors in the same way, where instead of trying to rehearse scenes and sequences specifically, they're really just trying to get them acquainted with their character and how the character fights. And then from there, the scene where kind of comes the day of or really close to shooting days.
Yeah, definitely. Touching on that Kickstarter point, that really was interesting to go into, and especially all their challenges going through that, and especially how the film was, you know, 10 years in the making, which is just crazy, but they made it happen anyways.
Yes, props to them. Props to them.
I do remember, though, Bao telling us to never do Kickstarter or crowdfunding again.
Yeah, we asked him for like a tip or one thing he learned, and first thing that he said, just don't do it.
Yeah, he was just like, don't do it. Just save yourself the headache and the hassle. But yeah.
Yeah, hopefully second time around will be easier for him.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, this is a very, very unique film in the sense that it combines, you know, that action with that comedy, which I feel like not too many action films do nowadays.
Yeah, and when they do, sometimes they'll forget to throw in the character beats,
definitely,
and the character moments. And this has that all in spades.
So this has a little bit of that throwback to, you know, Jackie Chan action Hong Kong comedy type films. And also there's a lot of really great character moments, like Mike was saying.
Yeah, totally.
Oh yeah, one last thing. We also have a new segment in there called the 5-Second Fight Club, which I really enjoy and I hope is a big part of the podcast in the future.
Yes, and we'll also throw out a spoiler warning here for the action breakdown section when we talk in depth about some Paper Tiger fight scenes. So be sure to go out there and see the film first, then come back and hear some of those in-depth discussions about it.
Yeah, definitely. So without further ado, here is the podcast. Thank you guys for being on the podcast, Ken and Tran. So Mike and I saw the movie a couple of days ago, and we really enjoyed it. A lot of great action, a lot of great comedy side to it as well. We were just wondering, you know, do you feel more of like a dad after making this movie?
I feel like a proud uncle.
A proud uncle who doesn't have to change the diapers. He just comes in, be a hero. And he like gets to entertain and
exactly.
Just like play with him
photos,
and then like, take some photos. Once it's soiled, you're like, I gotta go. Yeah. How convenient. It's nice to have.
Describes it all.
it's nice to have this baby out in the wild, and it's also interesting kind of see it kind of get on its own feet in a lot of ways, in terms of like people are reacting to it. People are almost have an emotional attachment now and around it, and they have their own ideas about the movie. So it's almost like this child is out there on its own. You know, it's going off to college, it's driving, it's bringing home the first date. And you're like, who are all these strangers? All of a sudden, you never met them before. It's super cool just to kind of see it almost become its own thing, and then obviously also in this time, in this day and age, you know, kind of give it a whole different temperature because it's being received in this in the state of affairs that things are going on with, you know, a pandemic obviously, and Stop Asian Hate. So it's an interesting it gives it all this other different subtext that obviously I never thought of when I was writing it in a cafe 10 years ago. So it's a whole nother element that's really fun and surprising, and just almost like it's out into the world, and it's its own thing now.
Yeah, definitely. It must be pretty cathartic experience to be able to finally talk about pretty much everything about the film and have people actually react to what you've been working on for so long. And yeah, totally new context, an unfortunate context for the film, but you know, I know you've spoken before about the Asian representation angle of it. And of course, there's been a rise in Asian hate crime. So seeing this as sort of a good representation of some strong Asian leads, definitely a cool component to it too.
Yep.
And before we dive into some more specifics about the movie and everything, can you give just a sort of general overview of both of your careers, and especially where those two careers sort of intersected?
With regards to action and screen fighting and acting, it's a very, very untraditional kind of path that I've been on. In fact, my full time is not even in the movie world. I'm actually a full time graphic designer, and I've just been friends and connected to this group of creatives for so long that it just feels like something that I had to do, that I had to be part of. I've always been enthusiastic about everything that, you know, Bao's been part of over the years, and it's been kind of, it's been a long journey. You know, you look back, we met at the end of high school. So, you know, we're going on about 20 years of friendship, all that built into kind of like those early days kind of informed that no matter what, he kind of wanted to be there for him. You know, you're kind of seeing the success, and you're kind of seeing like, oh, there's a special spark and creativity in the way that we work together. So when you find that, at least what I found in this group of creatives, you just stick with them the whole time. And I've never really gone off to seek roles in any other like Hollywood type pictures or anything, you know, here in LA. I've always just had the fortunate opportunity to work with very talented artists that are in the industry. And that's kind of how I've been able to stick close to these friends and keep these friends for such a long time. I know before we started recording, I was talking to you about Vlad and Manny, who have gone on to do, you know, some great action directing in their own right. So just kind of like being involved in that, like those early days, has kept me close to this sort of just this wave of new, I wouldn't call them new because we've been around for a while, but just this energy that's coming out with regards to action design and screen fighting and just the whole creative approach to the style of film that you guys are fans of.
Yeah, definitely fans. And that's something that Vlad touched on too, is this idea that even if you haven't heard of everyone who's maybe shown up in a certain short film or feature length project like this one, you know, everyone's been here for a while and everyone's been putting in work and growing together and learning from each other for a long time. So it's not just an overnight thing. It's a whole process.
Yeah, if you dig deep enough, you'll see the trails of how this kind of all seeded and became sort of what it's blown up into today. Kind of almost like how Marshall Club were featured in it. They're kind of taking the torch now, and with Team Red Pro and those guys just doing incredible work. And I'm just like, how did it go from these backyard videos to what Andy, Brian, Daniel, Joseph Lee, all those guys that are doing independently? Just like, my goodness, it's so impressive. And it's really touching to see that independent spirit continue on with talent like that. Like it's unreal, because I can't do a drop of what those guys do in terms of performance and martial arts ability and athleticism. So I love how it's continued on, and it's just gotten better every like phase of the way. So shout out to those guys. It's just this one big long family line of like these independent spirit, you know, type action filmmakers. So it's fun to watch it grow into what it has today.
Yeah, totally. And those are definitely some individuals I'd like to talk about a little bit later. We'll go a little bit more in depth about the Paper Tigers and the action scenes that are part of that film. Another question I had about the film from the writing side for Bao is, where did that fatherhood angle come from for some of your characters there? I feel like there's some really cool dad energy or dad chemistry between the main trio there.
Yeah, I think, overall the theme is about these relationships, both hierarchically and then to each other, you know, both with your master and your student relationship, but also to your brothers who also have sometimes a hierarchy, you know, whether it be your senior, your junior, and where you are in that family. So I think it feeds into kind of like the character's journey, especially about Danny and just kind of his relationship between his biological son and how he is essentially the master to his son, and how he is with his brothers in the martial arts world, and how those two are so different, because it's almost like, they're disconnected. He's not quite, you know, being the person that he is as a martial artist that he should be as a father, as a biological father. So it's a way of the whole story of finding a way for all those things to kind of come together for him and be integrated by the end of the film, and try to, you know, basically, you know, mean what you say and say what you mean at that point.
And for you personally, is writing sort of a main attractor in terms of film? Do you really enjoy writing films, or is that sort of a means to an end to make films that really come from you from the ground up?
I have a love-hate with writing. I have a love-hate thing with writing. I think when we all started out, I think all of us, just because we were started out independently and guerrilla style, you know, for me, the biggest big inspiration when I was growing up was Robert Rodriguez, Rebel Without a Crew. And that was like very freeing and almost liberating, and saying like, you don't have to go to film school. You don't have to go through this whole process. You just have to have the guts to own the whole process from start to finish. So I always saw filmmaking as a whole, only because practicality, because I didn't have a writer, proper screenwriter to write something. I didn't have a proper editor to do something. So you kind of learn everything, jack of all trades, and pick up all the aspects of filmmaking. So all of it feels the same. Like when I'm writing, I'm thinking about how it cuts. And then when I'm cutting, I'm thinking about how to make the writing sharper. So it's all like part of a process. So I never felt that division of labor, so to speak. But in terms of the actual practice and the discipline of sitting down and writing, I hate it. I think it's hard because you're on your own, and nothing happens without you actually putting words on the page. So everybody else, you know, is off to the thing, and it's not a real thing until you actually have, you know, a story that can actually mean something and has, you know, the whole through line. So I did have to learn, you know, screenwriting and storytelling as an art and craft in itself. But even then, you know, it's still a process because your script is still being edited on the day. You know, your actors might have some improvisational ideas, ad libs, and changes it up. You might have to cut shots. You might have to, you know, your schedule may not, allow you to get all the things that you wanted. So you have to make decisions on the day. And then also onto editing. You have all these choices, hopefully by then, all these great choices to choose from. And then you have to kind of sculpt the writing and cut back and add ADR and all those things. So it's all a process of things. So it's a little funny, you know, if once you're kind of in it, I think when you, I'm not calling critics to carpet on this, but sometimes people don't really understand like those process of how that collaboration between all the roles kind of make the film. People think just the dialogue, oh, it's the writers. And they say the writer's dialogue is snappy and quick or whatever, but sometimes it's the actor improvising. That was the actor's lines. Or sometimes the editor creates phrases out of those things. So so in terms of just like really understanding the process, it is all of one piece when you're actually creating a whole story with the flow of sound and image at the same time. So it is one thing to me. And it's all painful.
Yeah, it is definitely all painful. Darren and I are sort of starting off our filmmaking careers together. I'll do a lot of the writing, and I'll hear people talk about how a story, you know, wrote itself or something like that. And I just see, I must be writing the wrong stories, because nothing I make writes itself. You gotta bang your head against the wall a whole lot. And actually, I think Darren was wondering about, you mentioned improvising dialogue sometimes, especially with the comedy bits for Paper Tigers, for the one-liners. How much of that was improv, and how much of it was that, you know, pre-scripted punchline stuff?
Hard to say. I think it was a good mix. If you did kind of the breakdown, I think what we did was obviously when I would write the scene so it felt complete and that there was, a button to a scene or whatever, but then we would shoot that and then we would let the actors kind of do their own thing to kind of like riff. So we always had all those options. We had stuff that we had the script shot covered. And then we also had options where the actors, played with it and ran with it. So in terms of what it all came together, it's probably a whole mishmash between, between scripted lines and ad-lib lines. But, obviously with talent, the cast that we have, they're going to give you plenty of stuff to work with. So I'm sure a lot of it is just, a lot of that was from the day.
Options. Options are key. Options are key. In terms of the film getting made, there's a whole bunch of instances of you guys talking about how, you had to sort of kickstart the project on your own because a lot of the studios wanted to whitewash it and change really the heart of the film itself. Do you have any lessons that you took from the whole kickstarting process or any advice you have for other filmmakers who are looking to kickstart some projects?
Yeah, don't do it. Like, what are you, nuts? Just don't bother. Just quit from the get. I'm going to save you and let you keep on to 10 years of your life. And you don't have to shorten your lifespan in any way. So I think it's just don't do it, kids. I think that's a great way to go. Hopefully.
There you go. There you have it.
Yeah, there you go. So, straight up. Also, so that we can, retain our rankings. If you make more movies, it kind of affects where we are. We don't want competition. I hope by what we're doing, at least it'll open some doors or make some noise. I want to be clear that we're not the only ones. I think if you are a person of color trying to get any movie made, in LA or in the studio system, you're going to get those type of notes and you're going to get those type of roadblocks. So it's not anything that's exceptional in terms of what we went through.
Did your background in editing, Val, help at all with, directing the action and knowing exactly how to shoot and get coverage for those different sequences?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had that kind of unique luxury to have those creative calls in developing the action design. So I know it's not like that across the industry. Certain cultures make room for that. The Asian culture, the Hong Kong culture of filmmaking, it's just how they do things. Second unit takes control. The action team, the action director is the director on the day. So I was fortunate enough to be given those reins along with my just amazing stunt coordinators, Kerry Wong and Sam Wok, who are vets in this game. And having them by my side, kind of just helping steer everything along. Just having that access to, to be able to work closely with Bao, and to really understand early on what the vision was, what the intent was behind the action, was very important for us to kind of suss out over the years and just really come to the same page on like how we were going to approach the action design. So, while I may be credited as the action director, Bao's vision guiding, the type of action that he wanted to layer onto the characters was set, before I ever started putting moves to the page or to the screen, if you will. So all of that kind of early think tank session, kind of just like these creative thought starter type sessions that we would talk about styles and what if this would happen, what would it look like if Bruce Lee stopped doing what he did and 30 years later, stopped cold 30 years later, would he still remember? Would he still move the same way if he had a beer belly and, like out of shape, maybe had a bum knee? Like, what would that look like? And you just started playing with the idea and the visual and started piecing things together, different versions of that, what middle-aged out of shape might look like. And it's kind of reflected in all the other characters, whether it's in the mind or actual physical. So that was really great to have that kind of anchor piece to always go back and check against kind of the storyline or the characteristics of each of the tigers. So we always had that anchor to go back to and always cross-check, making sure that whatever movements we were designing reflected the story of each of the characters. So it was nice in that way to be able to have a reference and not to just, sometimes you need that leash to keep you within the bounds of the story And I think if it was just free for all, it wouldn't have made sense. You know, they just start flying all over there, all over the place, maybe doing backflips off the pool wall, like stuff like that just wouldn't have made sense. But because we had that real solid understanding, that tether to the story and to the characters, it really helped us stay more disciplined along the process of just trying to put the pieces together for the action design.
So. Yeah, and having all those quirks for your three main characters, the titular tigers there, makes every fight scene interesting. There's that creative challenge that they have to overcome and that we get to see, you know, visually played out. And it also, it just makes them really endearing as you know, at least in part underdogs for just about every fight that they go into, whether it is the knee, just old age, or forgetting your striking and kung fu abilities. Awesome stuff. And was there anything that you guys maybe learned a little bit from going through this whole process of making the film?
Again, don't do it.
Oh, you want to take that one?
Give up and cut and run. Cut your losses while you can. You know, don't even bother. What do we learn? I think it's funny because it's also undoing a lot of our habits, because I think, at least for me, you know, my kind of upbringing and training is like you want to find the beauty and make it look powerful and and how do you make all those aesthetic choices that you are used to doing to make, you know, an action hero look as strong as they can? But now this is peeling all of that back. So it's a bit of a deconstruction phase and kind of a dirtying it up and making it muddy and, you know, distressing the image, if you will. And it's almost undoing all of our habits and the things and the things that our eye kind of looks towards. We want those picture perfect frames, those picture perfect points. You know, when someone, you know, snaps a kick, or there's a nice snappy punch or whatever. But it's actually pulling back and going, well, is that exactly what we want for the movie? Is that right for this characters? Because at the end of the day, it's about the story and the characters. And it's not, you know, you want to kind of like hold on to that and make sure that you're being true to that. So, and a lot of times it's finding, you know, takes that we maybe taking the second best take or the not so great take that we might usually choose, but because we're making a creative choice that these guys are out of shape and we want to commit and tell that story, it's like going to that, even despite our best instincts, you know, if that makes sense. So I think that's kind of the interesting process, because we don't even know what we're trying to go for sometimes until you see them move.
Yeah,
you see them, actually express the choreography, and you're like, okay, that's a little too snappy, or that choreography is a little too showy, or too many shapes. You know, sometimes it's good to have we would do want kung fu flavor, but if it's a little too many shapes that are going on, you kind of want to shave it down and make it, you know, again, these guys are out of shape. Remind yourself that those are things and stuff like that. So. It's constantly surprises and then going with the flow in terms of, what you're seeing and presented, and then also what you're trying to go for.
I just want to add to that, like to Bao's point about kind of seeing what you get, like with the actors, we didn't have much time in terms of rehearsals with them. So it was very important, going back to what I was saying about the story being very descriptive about the way that these people would move, kind of the truth that we needed to tell in their movements. So it was important for that work to have been done, because when we finally saw Elaine, we finally saw Mikkel and Carter, or Matt Page as Carter, and even Ron, just seeing them move, kind of having some outlines of the, at least with the framework of the choreography, and just kind of seeing them and how they move through that space to get to point A to point B, and just kind of like seeing how the bodies interact. Things would come out of those sessions, just those little like kind of workshops. And, Carrie, Sam, and I would look at each other and like, that's not their move. Let's take that out. Maybe drop that on Matt. Oh, Matt can do it. So there are these things that we were kind of playing kind of like Lego pieces for the ideas that we had before we ever met any of the actors. We're kind of trying to piece it together because, you know, we're so creatively attached to certain things, but also those early meet sessions informed the rest of the choreography and how we would develop it around their strengths, and also playing up the comedic points that they were able to kind of paint in that I would never expect, you know, the way that Ron acted when he gets kicked, just the way he plays up, you know, kind of like all the ailments, and the way even Danny fights, he's got this hesitation. That's all Elaine and that's all Ron coloring those kinds of things in. And we gave them the moves, but at that point they were so aware of who their character was. The layering on they knew how to apply that emotion behind the movement. So that was super important. I think the only way we would have got it done if it was that combination. It's a testament to one, the work ethic of the actors to be open and vulnerable and to accept this kind of like strange way of moving. Because, you know, aside from Ron, who's a super OG in screen fighting and action direction himself, Mikkel hasn't done kung fu type movements, and Elaine is years removed from his taekwondo training, which he did when he was a child. So all those kind of things, all those kinds of qualities played into the design, and it really came from like the collaborative portion of it, or I should say it was all a collaborative effort to get what you see on screen. It wasn't just like I said to do this, to move that way. Not like that at all. You know, there was artistic input from every angle, and that's why I think it was such a fun but also effective at least series of fights.
Yeah, I just had kind of build on to that. Like I would like to say that we were geniuses for not having stunt doubles and having these actors do their own action, but it was really because we didn't have the budget for it. So everybody is in on it, right? But that, I think that really gave the flavor of a natural way. You're all in. Guess what? Yeah, but what happens is that it really kind of gives true meaning to the action acting. And I think Mikkel kind of mentioned that a few times. So it's like, you know, why bring a stunt double? Because he doesn't know what my character is. He doesn't know what my character is going to behave and react in this moment. That's what I can do, and that's his job. So that totally makes sense in terms of like these characters, little character flourishes, like Danny. Danny, after doing a BAMO, Elaine, and hiking up his pants, like that's him. That was Elaine's thing. Right? And then Ron gained 60 pounds for this role. Yeah. You can see him a little bit bigger than his usual walk around rate, but he's like 60. He gained 60 pounds because I said he wasn't fat enough. Wow. So I told him he had to start eating, and he started eating and gaining weight, and that informs the action too, because he himself can't move and, you know, kick and punch in the same way that he could 6 weeks ago or 6 weeks prior. You know, he can feel it within his body. It's not moving in the right way. Like, that's jiggling more than I thought it would. Like, it's like, it's this whole, like, it becomes a performance thing, which is a great thing. And it's really kind of cool to kind of see it all come together in terms of action acting being, you know, in actuality happening. Because we talk about action acting a lot. And I think usually action acting is reduced to, like, face expressions. But it's more than that. It's more than that. And it's inhabiting this character, and it's inhabiting... Yes. You know, what's happening in the moment and the trip and the fall and the kick or whatever. It's like all those little things are all contributing to telling a story through acting. And it wasn't until I realized a little bit later, it's like, it seems like, I don't know, by parallel or by chance or maybe by our processes, like Ken and I's process for rehearsal is really similar. Like when I do scene rehearsals, I don't do scene work. It's very few, a small portion of the time that I have with the actors, I don't do scene work. I usually do improv. I usually do stuff that kind of gives life, and they kind of speak in subtext or whatever. They kind of do all the things before the actual performing the scene. Do you know what I mean? And what I see Ken do is like he has them do drills. He has them do warm-ups. He has them do movement exercises, expression ideas, even just like bear crawls, you know, just anything that kind of is not the furthest away from actually recording, rehearsing your ones and twos and threes and fours and fives, right? He actually kind of does all the things around that until on the day or, you know, getting closer to the day, it's starting to put the screws in on the actual, the dialogue of the action, if that makes sense. Like it's an interesting parallel. I've seen him do that, and it's similar to what I do, because it's almost like I'm more interested in seeing or getting the actors up to a speed where they can be ready to play it versus playing it. Because that's for the day. Save that for the day.
Would you say you're sort of getting them, you know, introduced to the characters and developing the characters themselves as opposed to developing the scenes through that process?
Yeah, well, speaking for the kind of the dramatic scenes, yes, that's what I go for. because I want that life, the inner life, the relationship, and have all that in place so that when they actually say the lines, mm-hmm. it means something.
100%. And with regards to the action, you know, kind of the earlier sort of like movement lab type stuff that it would do with the actors was more so to kind of, in a way, to kind of build trust and to maybe understand or hear my voice and to kind of see how they picked up on my direction. Like I would start off with very simple things like stances and just hand forms and how many times do I have to tell you to, you know, roll your thumb over your, like just little details I'm kind of paying attention to, but I also don't want to complicate that early process. Cause like for me, it's serving as sort of a testing the waters with each of the actors to see, okay, Matt has a very solid understanding of blocking, but we need to work on his reactions. Elaine is very, very fast at picking up this thing and that thing. Mikkel is really good at boxing, but how do we interpret or make that or use that footwork in the corridor? So I'm looking and I'm kind of like just surveying, and you know, I'll talk to Sam, I'll talk to Carrie, and we'll kind of come together and huddle and say, you know, like tomorrow we're going to work on more footwork for everybody. The next day we're going to work on reactions. So we kind of piece together these fundamentals in a way that we're also earning their trust as we ease them into the process. And I mean, it's ripped off from the way that Bao does his dramatic, you know, kind of like workshopping before, you know, we're not working on choreography. And in some ways I kind of felt like I might've annoyed that, you know, the actors to a certain degree, because they want to know, like, what are we doing? Like, what is the move I'm going to do on the day so that I can start preparing for it? And in my mind, and, you know, I shared this even with like Sam and Carrie, as we're kind of developing the action, it's more important for me to get them to understand how their body works and what we need from them, just to kind of have that rapport, kind of starting to build that trust with one another, like I'm saying. And once that's established, then I can start asking to push. I can learn their boundary, and I can understand, okay, I can only push Elaine this far if I'm going to get the best out of him, or Mikkel, or Matt, or even Ron, you know? Having that process early on and kind of building that relationship with them was super important to the action team. And thankfully, all the actors from the kids and all the opponents, you know, during the teenage years with Guy, Mark Paletti, Yoshi, Peter, even all the opponents in the karate school, everybody was, we built that kind of relationship from an early point to just kind of set the stage. This is how we work. It's untraditional. I don't know how to do it any other way. This is how we're going to do it. And that was kind of like our opportunity to see who was going to meet us halfway. And sometimes you had to go the extra mile and kind of pull more out of them to get them to the halfway point, if that makes sense. So those early sessions, super important to the process, even though it was very short on time. But I think that was due to the crafting of the story being so, like, before we even started painting in, you know, all the different sections.
And you mentioned, I know you have, you know, the different age sort of ranges for your three characters. You have them throughout most of the film with the, you know, the middle age that they are now. Then you also have them as teenagers through that VHS coming of age sequence. And you also have them as kids in the very first scenes of the film. And you're talking about working with actors, getting them to know their relationships and their characters really well before going into the scene work. What was it like trying to get that chemistry to really mesh and synchronize well between not just your three main actors, but also three actors portraying them for the other age ranges?
Is the question towards like kind of the performance wise or kind of action, how they fight each other? Or?
I suppose both, getting to know how the three of them have that relationship physically and on a character level, and also how to keep that continuity from a young age to the teenage years to the adult age.
Yeah. I mean, as speaking for the performance side, it's a little bit easy because they know each other, like the younger period, like the Sadarsos are brothers and they've worked with Guy on several times. So, and Mark. And so there is a familiarity around that. So at least you're working with something. So that helps. I think, obviously they're very physically gifted and they pick up really fast, but also kind of giving them that swag or that vibe that we really wanted to kind of let them celebrate, you know, really celebrate their victories when they win and have fun with that. So, again, same process with the younger cast is kind of give them the permission to act with their action and make those expressions. You know, the little bit with like gi, tightening his little sweater like a gi belt, you know, those little things that he can play with, because that's swag and that's the things that they have attitude with, and you give them permission to that, to do those things in between the choreography and stuff. And so I think it helps and informs just even the way they throw a kick once they, you know, go through the whole process of being, you know, puffing up their chests. You know, you're going to throw your kick in a different way once you have that emotion.
Yeah, awesome. And I'd love to transition into breakdown, some specific scene breakdowns for the action here in the film. Let me ask one more question, actually, generally. So I know Ken plays a character in the latter half of this film. Was that always a role that we knew Ken would be playing, or is that sort of a realization we had later on?
I begged for this role.
And I had it as a carrot. Like, Ken, if you want to design the action, you got to keep doing this. And then we didn't even tell him until on the day. We gave him the wardrobe and was like, okay, you may play this part. Ken and I have worked, you know, a long time together. So it was no question as far as like, you know, that he was going to be able to play the part. I definitely knew we wanted him to design the action, but also find the right spot for him. Ken, like, sorry to keep putting him on the spot here, but I think Ken is the undiscovered or just the under spotlighted talent. I think he really needs to be shining a lot more. So any chance that I can do to put him out there and put him in front of the big screen, I will do it. So because he has such an amazing talent and energy that comes across the screen that I think all the audiences will like to see.
Yeah, I did enjoy the on screen Ken that we got in the movie.
Yeah, it was a dream to be able to work on a project that you kind of saw in its earliest stages, just to see it develop, and then to kind of see an opportunity to contribute even more and to bring something, you know, that you've been kind of holding on to and just hoping for that opportunity. And the fact that it's one of your, you know, good old friends from high school that you've got to see grow in this creative space, and to have that opportunity is just like, it made me very emotional when I left, because I felt so, it was such a gift from one friend to the other, just to trust somebody with your project and to kind of be that symbol within the film to carry, the characters through, at least give them that, that motivation to the end of the film, and to be trusted with that role was just, it meant a lot to me. I wasn't gonna hear any other way. Like, I was like, I gotta be this guy. I gotta do this role. Please, 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 please. They hung it in front of me. It was probably up until the furthest you could push it to announcing to me that I was gonna be able to play the part. But as soon as I heard it, I got to the gym. I started stretching. I started dieting. I started doing everything that I could to really bring like my A+ game the table for that. And I knew I was going to be stretched creatively thin, because you're doing that part, but you're also designing the action. But just it never fazed me, because I was so excited and passionate about the group that was working on this film, and the amount of work that they put into it just to get us to that point. I was like, no way, man, I'm not dropping the ball here. I gotta do everything I can to make sure that my contribution is significant and felt, and just fueled by that motivation of just like, this is the crew that I think is going to do it, and I'm here to support in any way that I can. So those are big roles to play, but I never swallowed it that way. I kind of was like, this is just what we're going to do. Like, these are my friends. I believe in this project. I'm going all in. So I continue to thank these guys, the producers and everybody, like, thanks for giving me the opportunity, because it did give me an opportunity to feel what it's like to perform in that capacity.
Speaking of swallow, what is your bone broth of choice?
It's, on the shoot, I was walking around with my protein shake, which is basically bone broth. That's how I got so.
Is it homemade?
So
is it homemade? Is it homemade or is it a brand?
It was not homemade. It's called Pacific Pacific Grass Fed Bone Broth. I think is the brand.
Okay, Pacific.
That I was
if you're listening, we
set.
Have an endorsement offer and a deal. Like your man Ken Kitagawa is ready to rock your product. So holler at us and get that out there. That bone broth of choice of Mr. Ken Kitagawa right there. That's gonna be the whole summer. That's gonna be the whole summer craze, you know. Everyone out at the beach just chugging bone broth in the height of summer, just 90 degree beach weather. They're just gonna be, you know, dropping it back there, just bone broth drizzling all over people's faces.
Get you some bone broth. Get it.
Yeah.
Get it. Fantastic, fantastic beverage for the summer heat.
I'm glad that we're starting trends. I'm glad that we're setting those trends.
That's what we do. That's what we do.
Yeah. I don't know what you would call it. Maybe you would call it hangry, but I think when it came down to when we were actually almost ready to have a start day, because Ken, you know, when you do the workout, you know, you're revving at a certain level. And then when you don't know whether it's screen ready yet. So you're only training at, you know, 70% before you kick it up to the next level because you know you're going to shoot, right? So, you know, we kept teasing our start date when we're actually going to shoot. So he was in that holding pattern and then he was like still revving at that high level. He's like, I got to go. My body can't take it. You have to shoot this soon. I can't keep this up. So fortunately we ended up shooting in the right amount of time, but it was funny kind of keep him, in that, holding pattern for a while.
I was suspended. It was difficult to hold on to that. For the 2 weeks that, I mean, leading up to it, there's a whole process of getting ready and fit, but to hold it is so difficult. And so like, I just had to keep thinking about the day, once the day hits, I'm, you know, I can't wait to have some Hawaiian barbecue or something, you know, thank God Kona Kitchen's up in Seattle and, you know, Yuji came through on that shoot day and I was able to just like replenish everything, man. That was tough, but worth it.
I'm glad it was worth it. And yeah, that bone broth. I wrote it down. I'll be looking into that tonight. That is marketable. That is responsive.
Yes. Come get you
and,
some.
We'd love to jump into some breakdowns here. We'd love to jump into some breakdowns here. So before we get into Paper Tiger scenes, though, actually, I'd love to talk a little bit about The Challenger, the short film from, I believe, 2015 that both of you were working on. First thing that jumped out to me watching this right after watching Paper Tigers is there's this sort of a slow motion effect, sort of Bruce Lee, Fist of Fury-esque, that maybe has some similarities to some stuff that happens in Paper Tigers. Was that sort of coming from the same place for you two creatively?
Yeah, The Challenger was a piece that we almost kind of like thought of as a proof concept or a test shoot, and just because we had the script before, so you know, I think we even call like Andy Lee Danny in the credits for The Challenger, but it was number one trying to play with old school kung fu, like this is like as clean an action that we wanted to get really nice and crisp, and like what is that, you know, quintessential kung fu action. That eventually the feature is going to, you know, completely, you know, blow up and tear apart and twist and break, you know. So like to me, it's like that's the classical song of The Challenger. And then you have like really dirty jazz for the Paper Tigers. Right. So it's trying to play with those two type of aesthetics of action. And then also, like you say, is to test out these Danny vision and really just kind of see, especially on a indie level, of the type of camera and slow motion effect that we can pull off, because we can't afford like a Phantom, which shoots, you know, over, you know, 2000 frames a second, which is a totally, you know, hyper, you know, obviously we know all those looks from music videos and sports advertising. And that's like, you know, the quintessential slow motion thing, you know. So we wanted to do something with a camera that we could use and afford and not have to blow the bank and figure out, you know, how to do it in camera, essentially. To get the same kind of feeling, the texture idea, and testing out, you know, all those things. So it was definitely kind of a workshopping on the Danny vision with The Challenger, and then kind of the where we eventually took it with the Paper Tigers. So that's the way I kind of see the two pieces, kind of both as classical and the other one's, you know, modern jazz. And then also as a way to develop the Danny vision.
Yeah. And one thing that I loved about the Challenger, there's this bit of the sequence where the camera comes low and you don't see any of their faces or their arms. You really just see their legs as they're sort of parrying in this dance of, like you said, really clean, really crisp trips and sweeps and ankle picks and things like that. It was different from what I've seen in a lot of the other Kung Fu films. I really liked it. Mm-hmm. And then moving on to Paper Tigers.
That was Ken's breakdancing. You can credit his breakdancing on that. His up rock.
Have you done breakdancing? Are you a breakdancer?
Oh, no. I mean, I think we all kind of tried to breakdance, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. Gotcha. It was all part of the hip hop culture. It was fun to learn new moves and kind of have ciphers in your friend's garage. But I never took it beyond, you know, a small circle of friends. It was just always something fun to do. It was a fun workout. Listen to great music while you're working out and kind of being creative in the same space. That was always attractive about breakdancing. But no, the background comes from, at least if leading into the action design, it comes from that similar group, but they were all kind of, we all took Kung Fu together. So I have a group of friends from back home that I came up with. We took Kung Fu together, and we also started our interest in filmmaking together. So that whole group, that whole sort of those early days, my VHS era tapes would be with this very specific group, which later included Bao. So that's kind of like, that kind of informed the foundation of our style of action, you know, the stuff that we were fans of back in the day and how that informed, you know, just the creative decisions we made for this movie in terms of the choreography and styling.
Awesome. And I'd love to get in a little more in depth for Paper Tigers. Again, if you're listening, you've probably heard this three or four times at this point that we've inserted. But again, spoiler warning, if you haven't seen Paper Tigers, please go watch it first and then come back and listen to some of the breakdowns. So first scene I wanted to dive into is that pool fight scene. We have essentially a series of three one-on-one fights that we have between our main characters and a group of three younger sort of Kung Fu people without a master, as they say. Generally speaking, how did you match each tiger, each main character, with each of the young challenger characters?
I think from a story point, we always knew that the lead punk, Philip, obviously as that group's senior student or Dai Si Hing, would fight, you know, Danny Eight Hands as the tiger's Dai Si Hing. So it just made sense for them to pair up. To be honest, I really don't know how we decided on Andy Lay versus Ron Yuan and Brian Lee versus Mikkel. It may have been a style of movement that they presented during rehearsals, and we thought it would just match up well. I actually, going back to it, I know that there were character traits written in the script, but in terms of just like the execution of movements and how that movement chemistry would be paired up, it was probably decided as well when we started to look at how they moved and when we were thinking about how they would interact with the tigers. So, and it just from a choreography standpoint, with Philip, Andy, and Brian, they're just incredible athletes and martial artists in their own right. And a lot of the choreography just came out of, let's just sit back and you guys go play for a little bit and let's see what you guys come up with. So it was very much about allowing them to bring out their strengths and also like giving them the opportunity for ownership in some of the movements. Like Brian was very adamant about doing a couple of the big spin kicks and we worked it into the choreography. Andy's intro, all those little artistic decisions, I didn't tell them to do that. They came there with that, and we just made sure that it told the story and it was a reflection of the character that they were playing. And a lot of that creative credit goes to just what they brought to the table and how they were collaborative in that sense to just offer up so much for us to play with and to kind of like fuse into the story with the choreography in terms of like how the tigers were going to react to their skill set. So working with those guys was just an absolute, super, it's just a privilege, a joy watching them move. They're like machines. you know, we have take after take after take of Brian doing his intro, and it's almost exactly the same every time. Like, I don't understand how they got that good, like, without any like formal training. It's just, it's incredible to their, and a testament to their commitment to their own craft as martial artists and performers. So, I mean, hats off to Martial Club. You will be seeing more of those guys in the future, because they're going nowhere but up. Philip Dang as well is I understand that he's got a very big following in the YouTube, Vietnamese YouTube channel community. Bao could probably speak to that a little bit more as to like his background, but he's also a wushu coach and a competitor, a top level competitor. And so having him come to some of the early rehearsals, it was just like, let Philip show us what he can do, and let's see how we plug it in with the choreography. So a lot of those movements worked well, because this is an expression of how they actually move. I never wanted to impose like, I don't like how you do that 540. You got to do it my way. Or we really wanted to get out of the way and let these guys perform and you know, do the best version of what they knew. And then from the Tiger side, we kind of plugged in the story to the ways that they move and kind of the creativity that they brought. We just kind of figured out where to plug and play, so that we were telling the story around kind of like some of the more spectacular moves in the movie come from those guys. So hats off to those guys, nothing but respect. And I'm super big fan of, I can't wait to see where they take their talents next.
Yeah. And in that first exchange I wanted to ask about, you have Elaine's character, Danny, fighting Philip, who we mentioned before. You start off in those first initial exchanges, not really any kicks. It's mostly, you know, punches and general arm strikes, highline strikes. Does that do anything for you in terms of the pacing of that one fight and the whole sequence in general, starting off with the arms and then going on to the legs and the kicks later on?
Yeah, for sure. I think for the choreography side of it, there's something about crossing hands and seeing the style come through, the handwork and the hand forms, and kind of that close combat kind of informs the readiness or the overwhelming sense from one side or the other. Because, you know, in some sparring, in some Kung Fu schools, the sparring starts off with, you know, just crossing hands. We kind of figure out where to go. And it's kind of a sensitivity thing. And so you get to see how overwhelmed early on Danny is by this, you know, this fierce young, you know, hot blood, you know, Kung Fu expert, this prodigy himself, Philip, the character that Philip plays. And I wanted to show the contrast in energy, the reluctance of, and the hesitation of Danny, but also like almost a version of how Danny used to fight, you know, just all in, you know, can't catch me, I'm first, you know, all that kind of energy coming at him, just to kind of wake him back up and a kind of a taste of your own medicine. And then eventually, you know, the fight kind of moves into bigger movements. We start to open up a little bit more once Danny has a better understanding of distance. And so then that's what leads us to, you know, him trying to kind of get his swag back, but it just doesn't work as we see in the result of him trying to go for it. So yeah, that was fun. Kind of working through that kind of mini story within the fight. Which we tried to do for all the fights, you know. We try to give every fight scene a little bit of a story arc. So,
yeah, and that definitely comes through. I think that's something a lot of people forget when they're thinking about action, is they'll forget about those story beats or those character moments that you need to really maintain that attention throughout. And I love how Danny gets knocked out at the end of this particular exchange, and then just like you'll see in Real Fighters, you know, he gets jolted back, and then he thinks he's still in a fight. He doesn't realize what happened. He doesn't remember being knocked out.
Right.
That was really cool to see.
Yeah.
And then after that, we have Hing. You have Ron Yuan's character fighting with Andy from Martial Club, of Martial Club fame. One of the coolest music cues, in my opinion, in the whole movie is when you have Andy starting to take his stance, then you have the trap part of the beat dropping as he takes his stance. Really cool stuff. Yeah. First question, burning question, how did you get that wig to stay on during all of those fight scenes?
Well, we couldn't afford stunt doubles, but we had stunt wigs.
Yeah.
Ron is a connoisseur of wigs, apparently, and you know, and in fact, it wasn't in the script to have that. But when he came in, And we knew he was going to play Hing. I was like, oh yeah, we got to take advantage of this, because he's got, you know, a pretty much clean shaven head. That's kind of like what he usually rocks. So I was like, let's take advantage. And, you know, for Hing, you know, this character who is about holding on to bygones and holding on to his past, you know, it definitely is kind of fitting around that to have that as a choice, first of all. And then what does that happen in the fight scenes? You know, what is that as a result of that? What does that happen in the fight scenes? You know, I didn't think of it as like, you know, let's come up with a funny wig gag. It's just like, this is a great character. What type of character is he? He's the type, you know, to wear his vanity on his head, so he feels young. And now he's you're gonna get his head knocked around by younger people, really, you know, actually younger people. So anyways, Ron has a collection of wigs. So when we asked him to get some samples, he went out. He says, I got a guy. Well, hold on, let me go text you. As he went, like, and he goes off that day, and he gets like, you know, I can see him sending all these samples of different wigs, and like, he really does have a guy. And he has a guy who has a lot of wigs, and he's like, and so we got a lot of different looks, and, you know, finding that right balance, A, between, you know, too over the top, but also what's kind of fitting for the character. But also we did have to start thinking about like, what, well, is this going to be really too floppy for the action? So thankfully, you know, once we settled on a look, it looked great. You know, it looked terrible, and exactly because of that, it looked great. So it was that fine balance. And then we found, you know, a stunt wig to kind of like be able to sit on his head a little bit more. And then you can put some tape to keep it down during the actual fight scene. So we had, you know, stunt wigs and picture wigs flying in and out on the day all the time. So that was pretty funny. So I think at one time, you know, maybe some of the PAs were playing catch with the stunt wig.
Nice. The stunt wig, not the picture wig, right?
Yeah, not the picture. Don't touch the picture wig. But the stunt wig was just getting thrown around. It was getting ratted about. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, and I see his character, Hing, again, going through that fight scene with the wig on, secured in place. Definitely conveys a very heavy style that he has. At one point, he's throwing, you know, 2, 3, 4 back elbows in a row, eventually just to break Andy's guard and send him flying back. And then you end it with this nice punctuation mark, where he's with his bum leg, with his extra, you know, you said the extra weight he put on for this role. He's ending with this beautiful, you know, he throws a leg kick, then a sort of spinning wheel kick of some sort. And because of his leg, maybe because of his weight too, can't stick the landing. At what point in the choreography did that sort of come into play? Did you always picture throwing some sort of a kick that's going to land him on his butt?
No, that's credit to Ron on that one. I think I don't remember how we planned to close out the fight. But he just had this, you know, I remember there was a moment where we were trying to set up the next shot. I think we were flipping the world or something, or flipping the set. And he had this great idea about how he should respond to Andy's kind of ass whooping. And there were a couple of options, but specifically that one was very attractive, because it was like, okay, he's just like, Hing's character's just going for it. And, you know, win at all costs, you know, kind of a guy. So him throwing himself out there is so Hing. And when we saw it, we were like, okay, but you can't land it though, Ron. Like, what are you gonna do? And Ron was like, I got it. I know what I'm doing. I know what it should look like. And he did a couple of versions of it. And Val brought up the point earlier. We picked the one where he falls, because he did land it a couple times, I believe, like pretty decently. And he just kind of played the knee versus actually like the full fall. So that was so beautiful to have, you know, during the edit, just to see the difference between, you know, what a clean landing would look like. Okay, that doesn't have the same impact as him falling over, because now we get the sense that Hing is going to do anything to win. And even after the kick, you see how much further he takes, you know, his frustration out on the punk, on Andy. So that's all, it all played well into that final kind of stretch of his fight scene. And again, you know, that was the fun about the choreography, at least the collaborative sense, because we were always open to those kinds of things. And you never know when, you know, you're going to see something or feel something on the day. So we have to make space for those things. And as long as we're disciplined and we're staying, again, like tethered to the story, we were open to seeing that stuff. You know, like we wanted to get the best out of each of the performers. So if there's something you think you might be able to add to the pot and it's going to make everything taste better, then we were super open for that, you know, to have that discussion and to kind of talk it through. So hats off to Ron for that. That's his little creative gem there. So he dropped that in on us. That was awesome.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of that observation because sometimes the actors and, you know, even all the kind of the fighters and the martial club and, you know, I can't point to a specific example, but I remember there was a couple times where they were just kind of screw around during rehearsals and they just kind of like do a little like move or some juke or something a little bit like that. And then you're like, oh, whoa, what'd you do? And like they, to their mind, they just, you know, screwing around, palling around or, you know, maybe having fun with the character. But they didn't think like, oh, we're actually, that's going to actually go in the movie. Like they just did it, you know, in the off take. And you're like, whoa, cool. That's cool, man. Put that in the movie, like do that in the film. So it's also like just being around and catching those moments and kind of seeing that comet go by and really embracing it, because they're giving you gems and jewels because when they're playing, that's the most creative. And then to me, that's the most free. And that's a little counterintuitive, obviously, with stunts and choreographies, because it is meant to be very prepared and expected. Everything, there should be no surprises, you know, sometimes in stunts. That's kind of the rule of safety, of course. But where do you find the surprise in all that? And where do you allow for those things where you can have those flourishes, those colors, those little, you know, little accents to put into the fight? And that's really important. I think maybe that's the power of just having, you know, Ken being action director and then having a director and just having all different type of eyes looking for different things. Because I'm not looking so much for whether something reads on camera and everything, because I feel like that's parts covered with Ken and Sam. Between Ken, Sam, and Carrie, I'm looking for little like ticks, you know, at character stuff and little stuff that even they just, again, like they're just screwing around between takes and they do it and they say something funny or they do something, you know, really funny with their eyes or their feet. And then they're like, whoa, do that, like put that in. So I think that's also like the power of just having a team that's in sync like that.
Yeah, getting those either insert shots or close-ups, little coverage of those, you know, little quirks that you mentioned. You mentioned Elaine before sort of hiking up his pants that we saw in this sequence. He does it once or twice here. He does it when he's interrupting his sort of salute, his bow in the beginning, which is an interesting little, yeah, interruption of maybe where he once was, where he could do the salute all in one motion.
Right.
And then part three of the scene where we have Jim, the character, fighting with Brian, again, of Marshall Club. Not a single punch thrown, I believe, by Brian. All really cool, spinning, flashy kicks, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we're ending with this really textbook sort of penetration step, double leg, full mount, this you know, X choke or cross choke, really. Was there ever a thought there about doing a fancier submission or a fancier takedown sequence?
Honestly, yes. There were a lot of ideas on the table for how Jim would finesse Brian in the end. It came down to not having enough time to get the specifics and the details down of the movement. So on the day, you know, I think we went through a couple takes trying to achieve it. And I think we just came to terms with each other, with Mikel and the action team. And we said, okay, we're going to resort to the kind of the straightest path to end this fight that still tells the story. It still stays true to the character. But yes, indeed, we did have a couple of ideas in the can or prepared. But again, it came down to like just on my end, not being able to coach well enough to give Mikel the proper understanding of like the intricacies of the grips and jiu-jitsu and judo is very, very intricate in terms of the placement of the grip and kind of distribution of weight while you're rolling. So there are a lot of things to keep track of. But in the end, I think the efficiency of how Mikel performed the final single leg shot to the full mount to the choke was very, very close to what Jim would do. I mean, in earlier scenes, you hear him telling the champ to take it to the ground and kind of upset at his inefficiencies. And this was a reflection of his coaching style and also just his departure from traditional, his Kung Fu training. You know, that's, you know, I'm sure Kung Fu, Shuai Jiao, everything has grappling, you know, we have grappling, but not that way, you know, not the way that Jim does it. Right. So it's a contrast to what Danny Hing and even the other punks were performing. Like this guy comes out of nowhere with this super, like, it's almost a commentary to like there's a lot of martial arts fans out there now that watch MMA and they're savvy to, oh, that wouldn't work, or this would work. And so the directness of him coming from the MMA world is kind of a play off of that in a sense. Like, okay, we got you. Yes, single leg shot on the guy that keeps kicking. You could take him down. You could choke him really quick, end of the fight. So there is kind of a little punctuation there to just kind of like give a nod and acknowledgement to the world that he's coming from and kind of like how far he's gone away from his kung fu teachings and knowledge. And he's resorting to this new thing. So I do like how we ended up using the efficiency of a single leg to a cross collar mount choke. So in the end, it was a lucky call, and I'm glad we had that option available.
it was a creatively stressful moment
trying to figure out.
It's a testament to Ken and his action team and his preparation to have kind of all these things in his back pocket, because with an indie film, you have time, you know, you are fighting the clock, you know, there's no real addition to a schedule. We're not a studio film, so you don't exactly get, you know, all this grace if you don't, you know, if you aren't able to finish in the time that's allotted. It's like, you're done. Like the location for this is done, right? You know, this is not gonna, there's no coming back. There's no pickups. All these actors are here for that window. So keep in mind, that's all those things. So it's a testament to the team to have those adjustments and mini adjustments and almost like watching the clock in a lot of ways. I think there's a discipline to filmmaking that maybe is not often talked about, is just time management. I think it's one thing to kind of do the things and get all the things in the can and, you know, you have all this cool stuff, but actually working in the machinery of a film and with obligations to a schedule and a budget, I think that's something to be aware of. And I think it's something, all the more reason to kind of give props and respect to the team that they're able to do. I think overall, yeah, it does kind of make it cleaner, because it does kind of make it, Jim, a little bit less fussy, because even philosophically, martial arts wise, our general sense is that, you know, it's better to have to do a simple technique very well than many techniques poorly. And that's what we were fighting time-wise, because I think I remember maybe the breakdown that you had originally, Kent. You know, it was maybe three or four additional shots to even cover a more elaborate choke technique, or a more, because you have all the moving pieces, all the little pieces to kind of make it happen. This has to wrap in, and this other has, and you're talking about three or four shots on top of that. And now if you're doing the math in your head, is that, you know, you're probably going to do about three or four takes, five takes. Maybe if it's an insert, you can kind of like get through it a little bit faster and bang through it. But I mean, that's easily another 30, 45 minutes. I know, like, this is how you're doing the math as a director. Mm-hmm. You're already thinking about 45 minutes on the day. So those are kind of like those things that maybe are the kind of the hidden craft of action directing and action filmmaking. And to me, I just want to kind of like highlight and you know, shout out to the action team on that, because those are the little things that kind of make you successful on the day, but also get a successful scene if you're able to kind of basically be the master of time.
Yeah, the schedule always being a big part of it there. And I know, Ken, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, you were sort of pseudo-speculating maybe part of that character arc of straying away from the gung-fu into the BJJ or the wrestling maybe reflected part of what you're going through right now. How true do you think that is? How true was that influence on this character?
I don't know. I mean, this, I know Bao and I had discussions over, you know, kind of people we've met along the ways, you know, through our martial arts training. And there was a lot of interesting characters and paths that our friends have taken. I myself, like I was telling you earlier, while I still practice and kung fu is my first love, and even though the time I spent at an actual kung fu studio is pales in comparison to the other arts that I've trained in, it's still my number one love. And I still practice, you know, some of my fundamentals to today, as, you know, just to keep fresh on it and just to always remember kind of my foundation. But I, you know, I went off and I did a lot of other styles along the way. And I was actually in some ways embarrassed to go back to my sifu and tell him that I was training in wushu or capoeira or Muay Thai and eventually Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is probably the biggest, like, what are you, you know, in the Kung Fu world, it's like Jiu-Jitsu and Kung Fu. If you've ever heard any kind of YouTube, you know, debate over styles, Jiu-Jitsu is always talking crap about Kung Fu. And then Kung Fu is always rooted in this, you know, this this tradition and this lifestyle and approach to self-development and all those things, right? So to be off and to have spent, you know, 10 plus years on the jiu-jitsu mat, in some ways, I really do identify with Jim because there's a certain weird kind of embarrassment as I'm kind of navigating through the jiu-jitsu world. Like, they don't know, my jiu-jitsu buddies don't know I'm like I've done all this other martial arts training, kind of traditional training. And my Kung Fu brothers, they know now, but early on, I wouldn't tell anybody that I'm doing these other styles. You kind of want to keep those worlds separate. So I feel for what Jim, the path that Jim took, and in the way that he took off, he was more heartbroken. So he was looking for another way, another path, another family. So jiu-jitsu provides that, you know. Like, I love Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I love the culture. I love being on the mat. It's, to this day, it still fascinates me. As long as I've been on the mat, I suck at it, but I still keep going because there's just something about the journey of jiu-jitsu. Is just, there's so much to learn, much like Kung Fu. There's so much depth and richness to technique and also the opportunity to put your own personality out there through the art, through jiu-jitsu. You know, like, my personality shines through the way I roll. In the same way, if I performed like a traditional broadsword form, my personality comes out. You have that opportunity to kind of put on your artistic touch, you know, with jiu-jitsu and with Kung Fu. So I think to bookend my experiences in the martial arts world, I really identify with Jim in that sense.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's great about the film overall, is just seeing some of those older, you know, classical Kung Fu movie tropes clashing with some of the modern day aspects, whether it's something very martial arts focused like the BJJ and the wrestling clashing with the Kung Fu fights, or if it's, you know, a fight that involves poison fingers being interrupted by someone having to go pick up their son in a minivan, something like that. It was a really interesting deconstruction, like we said before, and play on some of those genre trappings. And I also wanted to ask quickly about the Matthew Page fight of, you know, Ameridote Master Ken fame. I know one aspect that stood out to me is that there was a weapon involved in one of these fights. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how the dynamic of a fight changes, or the way this particular fight changes by introducing a weapon, both from a character perspective and also as a physical perspective.
I think from a character perspective, Val could probably talk more about this, but we had a lot of fun with the fact that, again, like, Hing would do anything for the win. So he was totally going to take the weapon. He was totally going to go for the biggest thing on the rack. You know, he wanted the W, right? So there was something really fun about giving Hing that, like, that extra oomph, or that extra, I don't know, power over Carter, at least perceived power over Carter, because in the end it didn't work. His Kung Fu was way beneath Carter's ability at that point. And it's just, I love how ahead of himself and how he'd just do anything for the win. And I think it was hilarious that, you know, the one weapon that he chose was kind of one of the biggest weapons on the rack. And the way that King knew how to use it, even, you know, like, even with the bum leg and everything, he still showed some proficiency and understanding of the weapon. But in contrast, it just also illustrated how good Carter got. And I think that was important for that matchup, just to show, like, you can have a weapon, I'm still top dog right now. Like, y'all ain't got nothing on me anymore. I've ascended. So it was fun to show that, to illustrate that through Hing, how good Carter has got over the years. So from a choreography standpoint and the creative approach to that scene, that was a lot of fun to play up.
And it was interesting to me. I feel like traditionally, if you had one opponent going for the weapon, then the other opponent going open-handed, you wouldn't be rooting for the person with the weapon. But in this case, again, we're sort of taking those traditional trappings and turning them on their head. It was a fun scene, like you're saying, definitely. And then going on to the final fight scene, I want to keep this super vague because I'd love for people to go out and actually see the whole film and see that final fight that happens. But can you just tell me maybe your favorite part about this final fight scene, or something about the process about choreographing it as someone who participated in it as well?
Yeah, I think just removed from the story, I think having the time with Elaine, because we shot the fights chronologically, and you know, the rooftop was our final 4 days of shooting. So by that time in the shoot, I had really grown to respect and become good friends with Elaine on set. And so we kind of, we started to build this rapport, and you know, that trust again was at a peak as we were walking on to the final 4 days of shooting. So we had gotten to this point in our relationship, whether you consider it kind of coach and student or screen, just screen partners, I guess, it, you know, as we're kind of like anticipating the days, we had gotten to a good point of understanding each other and having the ability to just be open with one another and our concerns at that point, because there, it was intense for Elaine and myself as well. I mean, that was not an easy 4 days of shooting. It was intense. There was a lot of obstacles to get through. You may have heard, like, we had the biggest lightning and rainstorm on one of the nights, which shut us down for about 5 hours. So there were a lot of obstacles to deal with, but I think because the crew and the cast was so well oiled at that point that we all knew what gear we were. We knew where we were in the whole machine of everything moving. And so I think at that point it was like, it was really easy to work with Elaine and getting, you know, all the performances out of him, and also giving me as a what do you call this, screen opponent, I guess, screen partner, something so like so fleshed out and something real to kind of engage with. By that point, I had seen Elaine work on the character up to that point. So here we are kind of at the end of the movie in our own mental edit of how everything's piecing together. So I'm able to look at Elaine at that point and understand the journey that he's been on as a character and what I have to bring to him as, you know, from my character standpoint. So it couldn't have been timed better, because I don't think the same kind of like energy would have been drawn out of us if we shot that earlier. So it was all timed appropriately and it just worked out really well. And Elaine brought it. He was at the peak of the game at that point. He understood choreography. He was listening to the direction. He killed it. So hats off to Elaine for that, for his performance up there, because I know what we asked of him was very, very difficult. And he never complained.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I feel like sometimes, you know, I've been on smaller sets and smaller shoots with Darren especially. It feels weird sometimes when you're doing the final climax scene, this big scene, right at the beginning of a shoot, because logistically that's how it plays out. It's glad to hear also that there might be some tangible benefits to saving that for the end, because you spend so much time with the characters. And it was a great scene too. So everyone who's listening, please go out and watch it all the way to the end so you can get that final scene. And so we're going to come up to our closing segment here. This is something that we are starting to do every episode now. We're going to call this the 5 Second Fight Club, where we, being Darren and I, are going to offer some hypothetical fights. Then you have 5 seconds to tell us who you think would win. Wow. So the first pairing here, you've had some pretty cool cast and crew members for this film with some pretty big roles, iconic roles outside of Paper Tigers. So a three-way fight, a Sadarso Power Ranger versus Master Ken versus Chosen from Karate Kid.
I would think it would be a toss-up, but Chosen wins if he has a rake.
Yes. Copy-paste Bao's answer. That's amazing. That's right.
Okay.
Now in yeah.
Next one. If we had you, Ken, fighting Ameridote's Master Ken, the Battle of the Kens.
Oh, man. I don't know if I'd be able to defend the groin stomp. That's too high level of a technique. So I got to give it to Master Ken on that one.
That's true. Those
rock, paper, scissors
are pretty killer from Ameridote.
Yeah. I think I could take Master Ken because I don't have a groin. I'm a eunuch. So joke's on you. Try to re-stomp this groin, buddy.
Nice. Again, trendsetter. Like we said before, trendsetter.
That's right. That's right.
Next.
Sometimes you got to crack a few eggs to win a groin stomp fight.
Yeah. A few eggs. Eggs of many kinds, yes. Next matchup is Sergeant Kiang from Mulan versus Hing from Paper Tigers, both played by Ron Yuan.
Oh. Did they get a weapon?
Sure, anything off the rack like that, like that one scene. Sure.
The toupee off the rack, and Ron can't be beat, or Hing can't be beat, man, undefeated.
I don't think Hing can be beat. Yeah, he's still on. Yeah, he's too slick. He's too sly.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the wig, he's unstoppable.
You might beat the body, and you might destroy the body, but you can't beat the heart. So there you go.
There you go.
Next matchup, we have a battle of the doppelgangers, Tran Bao versus Andy Lau.
Oh, man. If it's Andy in that fancy white beater in Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Stars. Can I say white beater? Is that passe now? But that can't be beat. You cannot beat that 80s getup and the tights and the A shirt.
Yeah, there you go. I'll give credit to Darren for that one. He came up with that matchup.
That's a great one.
And last sort of fun question here. Not a matchup, but we kept hearing Matt Page talk about doing impressions of some sort of alphabet of animals. Can you clue us in into what that is? Do you have like an impression of it? Anything like that?
Oh, yeah. No, he went the whole alphabet.
If you watch the movie, you'll see his... Yeah, he went the whole alphabet. We have... A good amount of, I don't know, probably on various different iPhones that have caught him doing the full run. I believe they might even have the footage of it, but
I think it's on the iTunes extras. If you purchase the film on iTunes it has all the extras where he goes through the entire encyclopedia of animals.
Brilliant improv, and it was the day. Like I remember when he went through the entire alphabet. Like it was. Nobody could sit up straight. Everybody was holding their stomach, trying to keep quiet behind the camera while he got through A to Z. But it was a sight. So yes, Matt.
Okay,
Matt,
there you go. iTunes Pages, extras. There you go.
Yeah, definitely check it out. He's a super, super talented.
Awesome. And I have my final two questions here. First of all, thank you both so much for coming on the show. And yeah, final two questions. If people wanted to follow the work you guys do, where should they go? And if they wanted to see the film, where can they see this film?
I'll answer the last question first. If you want to see the film, you can go to www.thepapertigersmovie.com or just Google the search results. We should be in theaters. If you catch this in May, we'll be in theaters right now. So check your local listings. And we're on all the major digital rental platforms, iTunes, Amazon, and on down. Oh, and then for me, I guess you can Google me. Maybe you go to pov-films.com, and then you'll find me on all the social handles. And just check me out there.
I only have one social handle that I kind of use. It's Kung Fu Kenny Official on Instagram. I'm not much on the channels, but you can find me there. Kind of active.
He's got a killer Zanga, though. Check out his blogs.
That's
on Asian Avenue too. He still has a profile. He put it. Yeah, it's all there.
Asian Avenue.
Nice. We'll check. I guess those don't go away. We'll check those out too. Thank you both so much for being here, ladies and gentlemen. Go check out Paper Tigers.
Thanks for having us.
If you liked that, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Stay up to date on the show by visiting our website, actiondecoded.com, and by following us on Instagram at actionfilmmakingpodcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.